You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, along with Melinda Francis. And we are here to do Diasporic Music. We kicked the show off with Rita Marley, and Rita Marley did so much things to say, and we are going to be talking to Ifeah Wangaza and Dr. Gerald Horn. And Melinda Francis, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, really good today.
And I guess big news in Canada is that the pipeline situation where what's his name, Justin has caved in. It looks like he's gone along with Trump on that. How do you see that?
I don't think he caved in. I think it was pretty clear that the liberals were going to do this exactly the same thing as the conservatives. So I think.
Oh no! I agree with you. He did. They that was their position all along. I misspoke because he was always on board with that from the beginning. You're absolutely right.
He didn't. Finally took the baton from Harper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. But we would like to thank Chairman O'Malley Shatella and Archie Shep. Chairman O'Malley Shatella gave me the space on Diasporic Music to do, gave me the space on Uhuru Radio to do Diasporic Music. And Archie Shep, he is from Fort Lauderdale, born in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and he gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And we're going to be playing a lot of great music from women and men, but we're going to listen to Margaret Walker. Margaret Walker was born in Mississippi, great poet, and then we're going to be listening to Marcia Griffiths, and we are on board. Let us begin the show with a poem. For my people.
For my people, by Margaret Walker Alexander. For my people everywhere, singing their slave songs repeatedly, their dirges and their ditties and their blues and jubilees, praying their prayers nightly to an unknown God, and bending their knees humbly to an unseen power. For my people lending their strength to the years, to the now years and the gone years and the maybe years. Washing, ironing, cooking, scrubbing, sewing, mending, hoeing, digging, planting, pruning, patching, dragging along, never gaining, never knowing, never reaping, and never understanding. For my playmates in the clay and dust and sand of Alabama backyards, playing, preaching, and doctor and jail and soldier and school and mama and cooking and playhouse and concert and store and Miss Chumby and Hare and Company. For the cramped, bewildered years, we went to school to learn to know the reasons why and the answers to and the people who and the places where and the days when. In memory of the bitter hours, when we discovered we were black and poor and small and different and nobody cared and nobody understood. For the boys and girls who grew in spite of these things to be man and woman, to laugh and dance and sing and play and drink their wine and religion and success, to marry their playmates and bear children and then die of consumption and anemia and lynching for my people. Thronging 47th Street in Chicago, or Lenox Avenue in New York, or Rampart Street in New Orleans, lost, disinherited, dispossessed, and happy people filling the cabarets and taverns and other people's pockets, needing bread and shoes and milk and land and money and something. Something all our own. For my people walking blindly, spreading joy, losing time, being lazy, sleeping when hungry, and shouting when burdened, drinking when hopeless, tied, tangled and shackled among ourselves by the unseen creatures who tower over us omnisciently and laugh. For my people blundering and groping and floundering in the dark of churches and schools and clubs and societies, associations and councils and committees and conventions distressed and disturbed and deceived and devoured by money-hungry, glory-craving leeches, preyed on by facile force of state and fad and novelty, by false prophet and holy believer. For my people standing, trying to fashion a better world from confusion, from hypocrisy and misunderstanding, trying to fashion a world that will hold all the people, all the faces, all the Adams and Eves and their countless generations. Let a new earth rise. Let another world be born. Let a bloody peace be written in the sky. Let a second generation full of courage issue forth. Let a people loving freedom come to growth. Let a beauty full of healing and strength of final cleansing be the pulsing in our spirits and our blood. Let the martial songs be written. Let the dirges disappear. Let a new race of men now rise and take control.
Yes, my brothers and sisters. We're talking about freedom. Freedom is what Brother Bob Marley stood for. Freedom, universal freedom for people all over the world. People in Haiti, people in South Africa, Bosnia, all over the world. This one is one day we shall sing our own song, and that's a fact.
We will sing our own song.
Nangadef. Nangadef is Wolof, and it is the language that they speak in Senegal, of the Gambia, and Mauritania. And it is a greeting that I learned that greeting from Yusu Endur. And this is Norman Otis Richmond and Melinda Francis, and Lisa Watson is on the buttons. And the last song we played was from our good friend, I shouldn't say our good friend, but Judy Mowat. She's not my friend, but I have met her, and she is a wonderful person, and she has done a lot of great work for the movement of African people. And I love the lyrics to that song. I think she mentioned Bosnia, but I won't deal with that. I don't know if I supported the whole question of Bosnia. But Melinda Francis, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, is united with Trump on the whole, I guess, the pipeline situation. How do you see Justin Trudeau since he's been in power? He's been in power, I guess, a year now.
Yeah, it's interesting also, like, he's framing himself, you know, like even just today or yesterday, I think it came out, where he announced that he's taking a stance against the Muslim ban and welcoming any refugees who are coming that they're welcome to Canada. So he's, you know, positioning himself as an, you know, opposition to that. But at the same time, you know, like on issues like the pipeline, the two pipelines, well, he basically approved the northern pipeline just recently.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump basically gave the go-ahead for the Keystone. So yeah, I just find it really interesting where, you know, he basically on one hand is the opposition to Trump, but on other kind of issues such as pipelines, they're walking hand in hand. So it'll just be interesting to see as we move forward, like basically that relationship develop.
And in their position on his position on the Caribbean, he's continuing the whole occupation of Canada's role in Haiti has always been negative. But they're in Eastern Europe, I mean, with troops on the ground. Canada's always been a baby imperialist, but it seems like Trudeau is trying to, Justin, that is trying to show that Canada has a little military force.
I think he's like continuing sort of like, I think in a lot of thing in rhetoric, it's a counter to, you know, Harper, but at the same time, he's still taking the baton, just dressing up the language a little bit under liberal terms. So, but there's not really been any change in direction, just moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Similar.
And they're talking. I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, you didn't.
Oh, so they're going. It's on hold. But you know, Canada's talking about sending troops into Mali, and that is going to be something that we will follow on the Diasporic Music. And I'm certain that Africa Live and all the shows on Uhuru Radio will definitely be looking into. We'll definitely be looking at Mali and the rest of Africa. But right now, we're getting ready to play a song from a young man by the name of David Oliver. He's called the Jamaican Man, and he did a song called Miz. And David Oliver was, he's joined the ancestors, but I met him one time in Logan Westbrook's. Logan Westbrook's had a studio in Los Angeles, and he was recording Busting Loose, I Feel Like Busting Loose. Charles, what's the brother's name? I can't, Brown, haven't seen your moment. But David Oliver walked in the studio with Charlie Wilson and his brother. And it's a great song by a young man by the name of David Oliver. It's called The Jamaican Man. I think he was born in America, but has Jamaican roots. But he has a nice falsetto. This is David Oliver and Miz.
We'll be right back.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, along with Melinda Francis, Lisa Watson on buttons, and joining us on the line from Greenville, South Carolina, is Afia Juan Gaza. And Afia really needs no introduction to people that listen to Uhuru Radio. And I guess the first question I want to ask you, Afia, is how is your radio station doing? And we're simulcasting right now, I believe.
Yes, we are. We simulcast Uhuru Radio every Sunday, and we broadcast various speeches and programs during the week. Amali Yesitela Speaks, Diasporic Music, Solidarity. Uhuru Radio is one of the radio stations that we broadcast in order to give our station political substance, which is its primary purpose for existence. And we're greatly appreciative to Amali Yesitela and the members of the Uhuru movement for supporting us in that way, because we meaning those of us on the truly conscious community, have little content from which to otherwise choose. So we're indebted and grateful for the support.
So we thank you. And Melinda, I think, is going to lead this discussion, because she's very excited about talking to you, because I think she says she follows you on Facebook, and this is the first time she'll be able to actually be in contact with you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So I guess first thing we could talk about is your recent victory. Maybe talk a little bit for our audience, a little bit about the background of you were charged in 2014. Maybe talk a little bit about that and your recent victory around that.
Excuse me. In 2014, in response to the murder of Mike Brown by Darren Wilson, there was a national protest to express our national outrage with the Ferguson grand jury's refusal, like so many grand juries across the country, refusal to charge, and the prosecutor in Ferguson to prosecute Darren Wilson for murdering Mike Brown. In many cities across the country, there were various forms of protests, the most popular of which was the shutdown of major streets and intersections, interstate highways, where there were elevated trains and suburban cars, to shut them down. The object being to, as Dr. King put it during the Montgomery bus boycott, to spread the pain around. And that pain would be to cause the general public, if not to fully experience the pain and frustration of the loss of the Black community, as symbolized by the murder of Mike Brown and the failure of the judicial system to hold Darren Wilson accountable, certainly the minimal frustration of the transportation inconvenience that the shutdowns imposed. So we in Greenville had a shutdown of one of the intersections here, Lawrence Road and Antrim Drive, which is near the site of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination here in Greenville. And a number of us were ticketed as a result of it. However, the majority of the folk who participated on the spur of a moment, as is the case across the country. We don't have, as we had in the 60s, the kind of training and orientation that guided the demonstrations, and that's one of the weaknesses at this point in time. I'll be the participation greatly appreciated. So there were a number of us who were ticketed, and the other folk who were ticketed accepted the court's proposal, which was to waive the fine and cost of court or to discount it, for them to plead no contest and not participate in any other political civil disobedience for 6 months, and that the charges would be dropped, although, of course, it remains on their record. I did not accept that because the purpose of the demonstration was to highlight the fact that cops are not held accountable for murdering us every 28 hours. Furthermore, not only are they not held accountable, they are rewarded. They get a 2-week paid vacation, and then are subsidized throughout the time that they have these pseudo investigations that go absolutely nowhere but are designed to exhaust the outrage of the community, whereupon it is then announced that the murderer has operated according to departmental policy, is paid full back wages, and is put back on the street, primarily in our neighborhoods, with a promotion. So that the purpose of this protest and all protests is to render the government and the implementation of such policies as ungovernable and unimplementable at a minimum, and ideally that the perpetrator is held accountable and punished. So since that had not happened in the case of Darren Wilson, and it is not happening generally across this country, and Greenville, South Carolina included, then I could not in any way cooperate with the system by accepting their proposed mediation or resolution of criticism in light of the fact that they had not made any kind of policy changes locally, and that police here, like police, law enforcement across the country, whether it's police, sheriffs, state troopers, all of these paramilitary units that prowl through our communities, harass and bully young people especially, hold the entire community hostage in occupation, have not changed. So there was no reason for me to change. And as a result, the national community came to my support, making telephone calls, emails, text messaging to the various governmental entities, from the mayor's office to the head judge at the municipal court, and to the city attorney's office, locking down their telephone systems, their switchboards, to the point that they were pleading and telling people to stop calling, that the charges had been dismissed even before I knew they were dismissed. So it was a people's victory more actually than it was a personal victory, albeit I am personally relieved to not have to go to jail. The ultimate objective remains unresolved, unmet. So it is our, and that is the ultimate objective being to, with public education, and to call attention to the immunity and impunity with which we are killed every 28 hours by law enforcement, security guards, and vigilantes. Last year, 1,153 people were killed by law enforcement, and less than 100, in fact, less than 25 of them resulted in charges, and even fewer of those resulted in prosecutions, wherein at the same time we hear Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump's nominee for attorney general, complaining that 68 cops have been killed. That's less than 1% of the 1,153 people that cops murdered. You know, that is a number that people whose lives were taken by law enforcement. And then you still have to add security guards and vigilantes to that. So there's an epidemic of state violence being imposed on the black community at historic levels, and it's critical that we respond in historic ways. I think that we really have to applaud Brother Micah, Xavier, Johnson, Gavin Long, and the brother out of Baltimore, Iga Busi. I can't think of his last name, and I'm probably mispronouncing his first name. But and the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army members who are locked away and have been locked away in prisons in this country for the past 40 years for the beat back against police murder that we experienced in the late 60s and 70s.
Go ahead.
We have to, so our plan is to have a people's tribunal where the facts of the situation and other situations, including the police murder of Deonte Mackey and others here in Greenville, are brought to light.
Are you listening to Diasporic Music? This is Norman Richmond and Melinda Francis. You want to continue, Melinda?
I guess you'd mentioned that unlike in the 60s, there was more sort of opportunity to for training for these kind of things. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about that and how as community organizers that can sort of be sort of like a goal in various communities in training people in these kind of actions.
Well, the training actually begins with having an agenda. And unfortunately, African people in this country have not had an agenda since the late 60s, early to mid 70s, when we were co-opted. Black Agenda Reports puts it, Miss Leadership class was co-opted with the funds from the so-called poverty program and other such buy-offs. To integrate into the existing system, or as Martin Luther King put it, into the burning house. So the first thing that we need is an agenda, both a local and a national agenda. One item on that agenda as it relates to state violence is certainly picking up the call of the Uhuru movement black community control of the police. The function of the police is to contain, control, and crush the African community, and we certainly have to get that boot off of our neck. So to the extent that we are able to unify around that particular issue and begin to engage tactics, and people confuse tactics with agenda. You know, as many tactics, different tactics as there are people. So, and we don't all have to engage the same tactics. But if we can all agree that the community needs to relieve itself of this occupation and to take control of policing in our community, then we can begin to talk about tactics, and it's from that point that we can begin to talk about what the training has to be. Unfortunately, one of the phases that folks tend to go through, and it seems that we're in it at the moment, is what we called in the 60s freedom high and the adrenaline rush. And media whoring. So we have folk who are competing with one another as to who's going to be on television as opposed to who's going to empower the community to resolve issues that are negatively impacting it. So that demonstrations become a part of a larger agenda, and the tactics are defined by that agenda and applied in stages according to the extent to which the agenda is being realized. That requires public education, and that is what we were attempting to do with attempting to force the government to prosecute us for protesting the impunity, police impunity, but were unable to do, and which is reminiscent of the sheriff in Albany, Georgia. Albany, Georgia sheriff, whose name I think is Pritchett, maybe Laurie Pritchett, but you know people can look it up, who studied Jim Clark and other sheriffs in the South during the civil rights movement and their way of dealing with demonstrations. And it was determined that the best way to deal with the demonstrations were to let people demonstrate and just lock up and be prepared to lock up as many people as required in order to exhaust both the supply of demonstrators and the momentum and the energy. Now, of course, we're underwriting all of this. You know, when people demonstrate, they sometimes get permits. We never do. We refuse to request the position of our permission of our oppressor and the people we protest and against. Secondly, is the cost of bail and the cost of lawyers. We in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, of course, ultimately came to the point of and established the principle of jail, no bail. The object being, one, to weed out the thrill seekers, and two, to not underwrite the system that was oppressing us by us paying the bond and our hiring attorneys. In my case, we forced the city to provide a court-appointed counsel. It's whether or not the attorney gets paid or receives some other kind of recognition as a result of providing legal representation becomes another matter, but it's one that the government has to bear and not the protester. So the process has to be one that comes from a position of clear political analysis, clear political objective, and a clear political commitment. And recognition of the fact that everybody has his or her level of participation and that they aren't all the same. And being prepared to, like a jigsaw puzzle, put those varying pieces in their various places so that the momentum is built, the movement is built, and expanded.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and this is Afia Wangaza. And have any more questions, Amanda?
I have lots. But
we only have a about 7 minutes, about 5 minutes. Yes.
Switching gears, going back to. Radio, because, Norman just said that we were simulcast today to me, so I was just wondering your experience running a radio station and how that's been in the past. Maybe talk a little bit about the importance of in radio and all of this.
Well, Juneteenth of this year marks our 10th anniversary. And our station, from its inception, well, first of all, we were a part of the campaign to create low-power FM community radio and were fortunate enough to be among the first to receive the low-power FM radio station licenses. We are greatly affirmed that you all, when the opportunity arose, that we were able to encourage you and we continue to support you in applying for and obtaining your own license. We had hoped that we would be able to encourage other organizations to do the same thing, which would give us a stronger nationwide network of conscious to revolutionary radio broadcasters so that we would more effectively be able to spread the word. And there is a benefit in internet radio. However, internet radio has extreme limitations in terms of being able to get the word out to the broadest diverse sectors of our community. Our station has always been about information for liberation. As Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report puts it, and as Chairman Amali Yasutela of the Uhuru Movement puts it, in the battle of ideas. So our station, from its talk content to its musical content, has an air and tone of resistance, political education, and motivation out of a human rights framework. We are constantly making the community aware of the issues that the national Black community not only faces but is addressing, so as to avoid the feeling of helplessness that the isolation of being in Greenville, South Carolina, indeed in the South, without a formal freedom movement can result in. So we listen to a broad range of different stations and programs where people are talking about the different problems that we're dealing with, whether it's anglicization / gentrification and how it's being met by Black communities across the board, or the onslaught of an epidemic of state violence by police, sheriffs, state troopers, and the federal posse as well, of which we expect to see substantially more given the rise of the Fourth Reich led by Donald J. Trump.
Donald J. Trump. I think we have about 2 minutes left. If you wanted to, parting thoughts, anything you want us to, how can people get a hold of you and whatever you wanted to add?
Well, people can get in touch with us at the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination. Our email address is mxcenter, G as in George, V as in Victor, L as in Land, @gmail.com. Our telephone number is 864-239-0470. And we're in Greenville, South Carolina at 321 West Antrim Drive. So we're here every day, and we invite people to come by and to work with us in advancing our various programs with a particular focus on ending state violence against the black community, the criminalization of young people by labeling and targeting them as gangbangers, the infusion, and now they're switching over from cocaine to heroin in our community, while at the same time we see great sympathy for prescription heroin addicts. So if folk are willing, ready to fight, come to Greenville.
All right. And we're getting ready to, we're going to do a tribute to Martin Luther King, and he's talking from Birmingham, and he's basically saying, let's keep the movement moving. And, we're going to be listening to, Dr. King. We're going to be listening to Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Wailer. And, we're going to hear a nice speech from Dr. King. And thank you very much, Afil Wangaza. Thank you, Melinda, and thank you for holding the buttons down, Lisa.
Thank you all. Thank you so much.
Take care. And
radio. Black power in black community.
McKinney Clemente up in the Green Party. No disrespect, we need a red, black, and green party.
Informative.
How wealth gets redistributed is that the workers themselves come to power. The workers come to power, and then we redistribute the wealth, not the petty bourgeoisie.
No degrading lyrics. Finally, the station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
You're listening to uhururadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we are continuing our tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King, and we have a speech that Dr. King made in Birmingham in 1963, and we're going to listen to that, and then we're going to hear Curtis Mayfield, Fred Cash, and Sam Gooden, The Impressions.
Dr. Martin Luther King.
Thank you very kindly, my very dear friends. These churches are really loaded tonight. Never in the history of this nation have so many people been arrested for the cause of freedom and human dignity. You know there are approximately 2,500 people in jail right now. Now let me say this, the thing that we are challenged to do is to keep this movement moving. Yeah. There is power in unity, and there's power in numbers.
Yeah.
As long as we keep moving like we are moving, the power structure of Birmingham will have to give in. And we are probably nearer to a solution of this problem than we are able to realize. And don't worry about your children. They are going to be all right. Don't hold them back if they want to go to jail. For they are doing a job for not only themselves, but for all of America and for all mankind. Somewhere we read, a little child shall lead them. Remember, there was another little child, just 12 years old, and he got involved in a discussion back in Jerusalem. As his parents moved down the dusty road leading them back to that little village of Nazareth. And when they got back and bothered him and touched him and wanted him to move on at that moment, he said, I must be about my father's business.
All right.
These young people are about their father's business. And they are carving a tunnel of hope through the great mountain of despair. And they will bring to this nation a newness and a genuine quality and an idealism that it so desperately needs. Now we are going to see that they are treated right. Don't worry about that. The Justice Department is already in here. And they don't have some small fish from the Justice Department. They have some of the big fish in here. We are reminding them at all times that these persons are political prisoners. And there's a distinction between a political prisoner and somebody who's there for getting drunk, or somebody who's there for engaging in a robbery. And we're going to see that they are treated right. And go on and not only fill up the jails around here, but just fill up the jails all over the state of Alabama if necessary. Keep this movement going. Keep this movement rolling. In spite of the difficulties, and we're going to have a few more difficulties, keep climbing. Keep moving. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. But by all means, keep moving.
Lord, they're coming after me.
Nanga Death. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist based in Toronto, Canada. And I remember going to Jamaica in the 80s. And I remember I actually brought back 25 to 30 45s, all paying tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King. And King was huge in Jamaica. And Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Wailer all paid tribute to Martin Luther King. And Curtis Mayfield. And they covered Keep On Moving. And this is the Wailers, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Wailer doing Gotta Keep On Moving. And then we're going to hear Bunny Wailer do Keep On Moving. And this is after Bunny Wailer left the Wailers. And this Bunny Wailer rendition was recorded as Bunny Wailer, the solo artist.
Been accused maybe someday I'll find a piece of land somewhere not far near anyone. Then I'll send for my love, 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 sweet woman, my two
Norman Otis Richmond and Melinda Francis doing diasporic music on Black Power 96. And you are listening to our tribute to MLK, Dr. Martin Luther King. And Bob Marley recorded a rendition of Keep On Moving when he went to London. When he was, they attempted to assassinate Marley, he moved to London and he hooked up with, I guess that's some members of Oswald, and I think Sly Dunbar. Sly Dunbar is playing drums on this particular track. And this song, I think Bob Marley was rehearsing this song when he fainted in Pittsburgh. He was in Pittsburgh, and he was singing this song, and he fainted, and that was the last time he performed, but he was just rehearsing. And, of course, the I-3s broke up, and when they broke up, they were hurt because they knew Bob was very, very, very sick. So we're going to listen to Bob Marley Keep On Pushing, the London version, and then we're going to listen to Peter Tosh, Walde Samayat, and he's going to do Get Up, Stand Up. And this was recorded in Sao Paulo, Brazil in 1980. And this features Sly, Robbie, and also the son of Lucky Thompson, Daryl Thompson, the late, great Daryl Thompson, playing lead guitar.
My success, I would say, was not financial, but I would say it would be more commercial. More people heard the music after a time because of the ingredients that I put in my music. As I say, you have influence and inspired musician. And it's only an inspired musician can put in that spiritual ingredient that can hypnotize an audience at the first note.
Heaven, Lord.
Success, I would say, was not financial, but I would say it would be more commercial. More people heard the music after a time because of the ingredients that I put in my music. As I say, you have influenced and inspired musician, and it's only an inspired musician can put in that spiritual ingredient that can hypnotize an audience at the first note.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporc Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, and along with Melinda Francis and Lisa Watson is on the buttons, and Dr. Joe Horn is on the line, and he is going to discuss the 89th Academy Awards, and Dr. Horn is he holds the John J. and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston. He received his Ph.D. from Columbia University and a J.D. from the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of Class Struggle in Hollywood, 1930 to 1950, Moguls, Mobsters, Stars, Reds, and Trade Unionists, and another book called The Victims of the Blacklist, John Howard Lawson, Dean of Hollywood 10. And Dr. Horn has lived in Zimbabwe, Hong Kong, Santa Barbara, New York City, and he's currently based in Houston, Texas. How are you doing, sir?
Thank you for inviting me.
How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
All right, I guess the first question is, what do you think about the turnaround or the flip-flop on the Academy Awards? Last year there was a big outcry and no black folks were anywhere to be found.
Well, I think what it bespeaks is the controversy. What I mean is that there are those who suggest, well, why are people upset and concerned about a dearth of nominations for people of color for the Oscars? Isn't this just another ruling class institution? And the answer is, yes, it is another ruling class institution. But at the same time, folks need to realize is that with Oscar nomination comes more attention to films and filmmakers. And given the fact that historically many African filmmakers in particular have been in the forefront of trying to put progressive images on the silver screen, when they get more attention, then I think that the political climate in North America, and generally I would say worldwide, improves. Having said that, it's disappointing that Birth of a Nation, the film written, starring, and directed by Nate Parker, was driven into the dust, driven into the ground by the attacks on his life, including the fact that he was accused and acquitted of raping a Euro-American woman who then committed suicide. That particular controversy, which only became known after his film received attention at the Sundance Film Festival about a year ago, in January 2016, effectively sunk that film, which I think is very unfortunate in a sense, because just looking at the film, it's one of the more remarkable depictions of a slave revolt since the film done by the Italian director Pontecorvo, starring Marlon Brando, and speaking of Burn, which in some ways is a recounting of the Great Haitian Revolution. I was happy to see that the documentary by Ava DuVernay, you may recall that she directed Selma, the
yes.
depiction of Martin Luther King and the anti-Jim Crow advocates of some decades ago. Her documentary 13th, which is a documentary about the prison industrial complex in the United States and its negative and, in fact, malevolent impact on black people in particular, is really worth seeing. And, of course, it's been distributed through Netflix, which has been advertising it quite a bit lately, which is a good sign. And the film is certainly well worth viewing. I cannot recall if Zero Days received an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary. But once again, this film is well worth seeing. It deals with the cyber warfare that was launched by Israel and the United States against Iran and Iran's nuclear facilities in the early days of the Obama administration, circa 2009, circa 2010, and in the latter stages of the Bush administration, just before that, 2008. And what happens is that there was an attempt to infect the Natanz nuclear facility in Iran with a worm and a virus, but as so often happens, it spun out of control. In fact, according to this film, the Israelis were largely responsible for that because they were so hysterical about Natanz that they went ahead without proper safeguards. And then when this worm and virus was unleashed, it eventually backfired because the Homeland Security United States of America found that many computer systems in this country were infected by the Stuxnet virus. And then the United States government had to spend millions of dollars trying to restrain that. And then the Iranians were so upset that in 2013, they sent a shot over the bow to the United States by helping fundamentally to shut down the entire U.S. banking system, if you'll recall. Now, this is very serious stuff because cyber warfare can be used to derail trains, to shut down electricity, which would prevent hospitals from operating, leading to loss of life. It could destabilize nuclear facilities, which is what the United States and Israel tried to do, which could lead to the spread of nuclear waste and worse. And so this is a new form of 21st century warfare. And what I found striking when watching Zero Days was that with all the controversy concerning the allegation of Moscow hacking into the U.S. electoral system, supposedly helping to push Donald J. Trump into the White House, there was little mention of this cyber warfare episode that I'm recounting to you as represented in the documentary film Zero Days. And I think that that's a tremendous oversight.
Are you listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio? There was a Iranian filmmaker that has been banned. Not banned, but who can't come to the U.S. because of Trump's new situation with the immigration. I don't know if that's been overturned, but and I can't recall the name of the film, but he's an Iranian filmmaker. He was nominated for an Academy Award. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, yes. I mean, not only that particular filmmaker, but as you probably know, Donald J. Trump has just really thrown a spanner into the works. That is to say, people who are documented, the immigrants, who may have gone home for a funeral or may have gone home for holidays, are finding that they cannot enter the United States. Now, what's striking is that the hysteria in the United States was that there was no opposition, allegedly, to legal immigration. The objection, supposedly, was to illegal immigration, and yet people being barred are legal immigrants. Not only that, but the countries from which they're barred do not include Saudi Arabia, which supplied 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11, 2001, doesn't include Pakistan, which, by the way, has been implicated in nuclear proliferation, as represented in the documentary Zero Days that I just made reference to. And it doesn't include a number of countries, predominantly Muslim countries, where Trump and his family have financial interests.
Afghanistan is not included either. Yeah.
Afghanistan is not included either. And so but I think people need to realize there's a lot of idealism about the United States, including by some forces on the left. That's because they don't have a handle and a grip on the history of this country. That is to say, we have to realize that Donald J. Trump did not get 63 million votes by accident. He didn't get 63 million votes because of the machinations of Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. He got 63 million votes because the United States has a history of slavery and white supremacy, and that there are a lot of reactionary forces in the United States. He did not get 53% of vote of white women by accident, the fact that a confessed sexual predator got so many votes. He did not get 58% of the white vote generally by accident. I mean, people need to realize that about 25 years ago, a known Klansman and Nazi party member, David Duke, won 55% of the white vote while running for governor of Louisiana. The white vote voted in Jesse Ventura, a professional wrestler, as governor of Minnesota. This was part of their these voters' contempt for the country they supposedly worshiped, the United States of America. The white vote voted in Arnold Schwarzenegger, a fading B actor, as governor of California. I mean, there's a lot of cry now about supposed economic misery of the white working class and white middle class that's led to this disastrous debacle on November 8th, 2016. But somehow the black community, which has suffered more than most economically and financially, didn't vote for the right. So obviously financial misery is not enough to explain the result of this election. I think that when Donald J. Trump started talking about Make America Great Again, that was code language for going back to a time when white supremacy seemed to be unrivaled and unchallenged. And it seemed to be a throwback to an era when white male heteropatriarchy was ascendant. And that's why many people voted for him. Not only that, but I was just in Berkeley, California recently doing research at the University of California. And you may recall that a few years ago, the white vote once again voted to overturn affirmative action at the University of California. Mm-hmm. And just before the vote, the white student population of the University of California, Berkeley, was about 75%. But that wasn't enough. They thought, you know, these unqualified Negroes and Mexicans, they need to be ousted, and then the white population will then skyrocket. Well, now, of course, the student body at the University of California at Berkeley is about 65% Asian Pacific. And so, and the white population is going down to 20%. And of course, these folks are flummoxed. They did not intend this kind of result. And this leads to their continuing hysteria, because no matter how and where they turn when they try to bring back the past does not seem to return. Let's hope that that also takes place with their latest fiasco, putting Donald J. Trump with the impulse control of a four-year-old into the White House.
Melinda, you have a question?
I guess going back to, the Oscars nomination, and I'm just curious of, like, just to remind audiences what actually, like, change happened to bring about more diversity within the Oscars, and basically did they meet their quota of, like, bringing in more people into the Academy or that kind of stuff? I don't know if you know details around that.
Well, as you probably know, the term quota in the United States, when applied to people of color, is a bad word. You're not supposed to use that word. You're supposed to talk about diversity. And yes, Sheryl Isaacs, who is the head of the Motion Picture Academy in Los Angeles, is a black woman. And she did try to diversify the number of folks who vote on nominations. And apparently that had impact. It's quite striking how this evolved, though. As you probably know, Denzel Washington got a nomination for Fences, which is a cinematic depiction of the August Wilson play Fences, about the deferred dreams of a sanitation worker in Pittsburgh who had been a baseball player during the era of Jim Crow and therefore was not able to ascend to the highest level of that particular sport, and now is a frustrated sanitation worker, with Denzel Washington both starring and directing. And that film has done fairly well at the box office. That received a nomination. And then, of course, there's Moonlight, which is a film, a black film, predominantly black cast, that has a LGBTQ theme to it. So the efforts by Sheryl Isaacs to diversify those who vote on these nominations apparently did work in terms of diversifying the number of nominations.
What about Hidden Figures, my brother?
Well, I haven't seen Hidden Figures. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
And your opinion is?
I think it is showed the brilliance of African people in general and African women in particular. And it also shows colonized people being used by those who colonize them. It reminds me, the man who introduced me to you was a man by the name of Samori Marksman, and he pointed out to me that the Battle of Dien Bien Phu is when the Vietnamese defeated the French, and the frontline soldiers were from Guinea, Mali, Senegal, and during the Ashanti Wars in West Africa, the West Indian Regiment fought against the Ashantis. And to me, it showed how the colonizer are always used by the colonizer. But the film showed the brilliance of black people, and the acting is superb. Or the music, the soundtrack is unbelievable. It was like going back to you know, when I was a kid. You know, it opens up with I guess Ray Charles is a man who we have problems with politically, but you know, sticks and stones, and you know, the soundtrack, the acting, it's great. But like I'm saying, it shows how colonized people are being used by those who oppress them.
Well, briefly, for those who may not be familiar, Hidden Figures deals with these black women characters in a true story who helped the National Aeronautics and Space Administration some 60 odd years ago, with regard to their math capability in helping to propel people into outer space. And Janelle Monáe, I believe, is one of the characters. Taraji Henson is one of the characters. Octavia Spencer is one of the characters. And Kevin Costner, the actor who you may recall from, among other things, Dances with Wolves more than a quarter of a century ago, is one of the characters as well.
He plays the nice white guy. Yeah, it's he's the one that fought for them. Yes. Yeah. But I think people should definitely see it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's a film, there's not a film, but there's a story, and this whole fake news thing. There was a woman who helped the submarine, I think it had something to do with the submarine, creating the submarines, was an African woman from Arkansas. And there is someone, I'm trying to, We have got a contact with her son. She's still alive, but we're trying to get a hold of her. But it's another story to be told. They're basically saying that her story should be told as well.
Oh, I see.
And are you writing any books on Hollywood right now? Another book on Hollywood?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm right in the middle of trying to edit this manuscript. I probably sent off today on 17th century slavery and the roots of capitalism, white supremacy, and slavery in the 17th century.
Okay. Any other questions, Melinda? We have about 12 minutes.
Well, I mean, also, like, I guess people, I guess, over the pond, they had similar sort of movement against the wards, and they've had a similar like overhaul. I just wanted to know if you have been following that as well, which is the Brit Awards, which is actually scheduled to the same time around the Oscars. So I was just wondering if you had any comment on that.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that you may want to bring Canada into this discussion as well, but generally speaking, I find, and you know, this is not a difficult record to surpass. This is not a difficult record to surpass, but I find generally that Britain, despite having a smaller black population in the United States, oftentimes it's better in terms of these issues regarding diversity. I mean, for example, keep in mind, like, look at the reaction to what amounts to the Muslim ban in North America. just enacted by Donald J. Trump. Theresa May, or Theresa Appeaser, as they now call her, given her snuggling up to Donald J. Trump, criticized it. Boris Johnson, the maniacally right-wing foreign minister, criticized it. And people in the United States are sort of in a bubble. They have this illusion about this country, and they don't seem to realize that this is the right-wing anchor of humanity right now, and has been for some years now. They don't seem to get that. They don't seem to realize it. And so likewise, with regard to the Oscars, I have found that there's been, or excuse me, with regard to film awards, there's been more pressure in London, to use the current term, diversify, than in Los Angeles. I mean, what about Canada? I mean, with regard to the CBC and with regard to the funding, the National Film Board, and its attempts to hand out money to filmmakers.
And I think Melinda Francis is qualified to answer that question.
Well, I think they have a long way to go, just in production standpoint, and actually creating sort of a base of developing actual productions within the country in general, let alone for filmmakers of color. So, there just needs to be more general development of Canadian film. And for independent film, for example, that is away from, the American market. So I don't have really anything great to say about that, but it's pretty much very white as well. So
I find the CBC, yeah. The CBC, has people fighting over on the TV side, on the radio side, and I guess it probably can apply to the National Film Board, as they pick people, they pick you, and then they drop you real quick. And we're given a chance. It's almost like temporary work. Good friends of ours are the Sutherlands, like David and Seth Sutherland and his wife Jennifer Holness. Every 5 years, they're given a TV series on CBC, and they promote it. Then they have to come back in another 5 years, and it's you might get a job at CBC now for 3 months, and then they'll bring in somebody new, and most of the people 50 and over have been pushed out for younger people, which is, I guess, that has more to do with capitalism than it has to do with Canada. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Keep it cheap. You know what I mean? Because if you're 50, 60 years old, you want top dollar. So they're saying, well, we're going to cut you, hire someone else, and then give them like a 3-month contract with no benefits. And we're gonna save some money. I think that's a Canadian thing that's happening, but that's really a capitalist thing, if that makes any sense, Gerald.
Well, it does. But what strikes me is that, as I understand it, the CBC and the National Film Board are government entities.
That is correct.
Which means that presumably they can be influenced by elected political representatives, unlike Los Angeles and Hollywood, which is all private capital. And by the way, you should know that there has been a tidal wave of Chinese capital flooding into Los Angeles. This is what I mean with regard to these voters helping to execute maneuvers that they then object to. I mean, this is obviously a result of what happened more than four decades ago when Richard M. Nixon made overtures to China, enlisting it in an anti-Soviet coalition. The payoff was inward direct investment into China. by U.S. transnational corporations who thought that they could exploit China forever more. But now China's turned the tables and has begun developing these world-class entities, including, by the way, state-owned enterprises, by the way. And they're flooding capital into Los Angeles, AMC Theaters, which, of course, is a major place where films were exhibited. South of the Canadian border is owned by Chinese capital.
Right.
And so what I'm curious to hear you speak about is, given the fact that the CBC and the National Film Board are public entities, does that make them easier to influence through your elected representatives?
Oh, we have Justin Trudeau is the majority leader, and the NDP is in flux because Peter Montclair is on his way out, and Justin is moving to the the foreign minister now is a brother from Somalia, not foreign minister, but there's a minister now that is from Somalia. But in terms of the funding aspect, it is not as easy to get money from Canada, especially, let me put it this way, if you have a left of center type of slant, it's harder to get money because there are, to use Glenn Ford's term, the black misleadership class and the watered down class, they're getting a lot of the money, if that makes sense, what I'm saying, Melinda.
Yeah, well, and then also there's support, or like maybe because production is not funded. So like you have, you know, sort of supports to, you know, access, you know, for different programs, but the actual, you know, producing of films are affected by also market forces. To go back to your likely, if you have a certain topic, would get that funding rather than, you know, something that, you know, TV that's cheap and easy and has a lot of audience. So I think it's, you know, like CBC is not strictly like a government thing. It's half privatized, you know. So it's not simple to just go to your MP and say, you know, thing, because it's not straightly like a public institution, I would say, you know.
Let me say this, Gerald, and I think also the films like Lawrence, Clement Virgo and Lawrence Hill did that brilliant film, The Book of Negroes. They got a lot of support from South Africa as well as the U.S. So it's like a, what do you call that when you co-producers? They got Canadian support, but they had, in addition to that, they had to go out and get support from the international market.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's not straight, mm-hmm. like there's not a straight Canadian kind of industry.
And fortunately for oppressed people, we can do deals with South Africa, we can do deals with Nigeria or Senegal, Burkina Faso, and I think that Lawrence Hill and Clement Virgo have gone to Africa. And they understand those contradictions, not contradictions, but those things. But we only have a minute left. I would like to thank you, Gerald, and can
thank
bring
you for
back.
Inviting me.
I'd like to bring you back very soon.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, and we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. I'd like to thank Melinda Francis, and I would also like to thank Lisa Watson, and we would like to thank Afia Wangava. And Dr. Gerald Horn, until next week, we will see you in the whirlwind.